This is the IBJ podcast for the week of August 17th, 2020, brought to you by the law firm Krieg DeVault. I'm Mason King. Well, welcome back to the podcast, everybody. Now, those of us who have been working from home since the beginning of the pandemic did a pretty amazing thing in that first month. We proved that we could do our jobs, or at least a significant portion of our jobs, from our homes. This isn't something that a lot of employers cared to know about or deal with before the pandemic. Hopefully they're grateful to have that option now. But here's the problem. A vast majority of us are burning out on remote work, according to a recent survey from Monster.com and my own personal experience. At the very least, many of us are in remote working ruts. At the beginning, we did what we needed to do to make it work, and since then, we've been in a holding pattern. As the weeks have stretched into months and the days seem to meld into each other, we still have many of the same bad habits that we started with. I personally have developed several new ones, including taking naps at mid-morning and then making up for it during lunch, which doesn't really do me very much good. As many of us face at least several more months of working from home, it's beginning to dawn on us that this can't be as good as it gets. We're going to need to get better at this. Surely there are ways to tighten our focus and become more productive while keeping our jobs from seeping into the rest of our home lives. And we need help from our managers, some of whom haven't figured out how managing a virtual workforce is different from supervising on-site employees. In the last week, I've spoken with three experts in the transition to remote working to get some concrete suggestions for how we and our bosses can get on top of these challenges. I also asked members of the Midtown Parents Facebook group here in Indianapolis to give me an idea of their frustrations and to suggest any fixes they've discovered. We'll talk about those during the interviews, the first of which is with two members of the faculty at the IU Kelly School of Business at IUPUI. The second is with a local executive for digital marketing powerhouse Salesforce, who actually has written a book about remote working since the pandemic. But first up, we have Kim and Todd Saxton, who, yes, are married and had been using remote learning techniques in their classes for many years before the pandemic. Here's our conversation. So joining me in the IBJ podcast virtual studio is Todd Saxton, Associate Professor of Strategy and Entrepreneurship at IU Kelly School of Business at IPUI. Hey, Todd.
Morning.
And Kim Saxton, Clinical Professor of Marketing at IU Kelly School of Business at IPUI. How are you?
I am great. Thanks for having us on.
Well, my theory is that many of us are falling into ruts with remote work since the initial transition period and proving that we could get a lot of our work done this way. And then maybe right now we're kind of coasting, waiting for the magical time when we no longer have to do this. Does that sound plausible to you?
Definitely. I mean, we definitely have all gotten our little habits. I know Ty could probably share some of his that, you know, maybe not everybody wants to know, but still they are habits.
Yeah. So I think you're absolutely right. And companies are experiencing this as well as individuals, right? Is that initially it was kind of like, yikes, this is a big transition. Hey, this isn't so bad. I get my day back, not commuting, et cetera. But you kind of fast forward through not just weeks, but months of that. And at least for some organizations into the anticipated future and organizationally, as well as individually, we are in some ruts and you start to realize that, for example, that commute time that, yeah, it was kind of a pain, but it was a transition time from family to work. It was a time to listen to podcasts or the news and kind of catch up, but also mentally kind of shift gears to be fully focused on what you were going to do in the office and what you were going to accomplish. And now we're kind of in this state where we're constantly balancing both worlds or several worlds without any kind of transition time. And there's some costs associated with that and being aware of that and sensitive to it, I think, is important.
Because you guys brought it up, what are some of the bad habits that you're falling into?
Well, I would say one of my bad habits, and I bet others do this too. So because I had to go somewhere before, I would get up, I'd get a little exercise, I'd play with the dogs, I would do a couple things, and then I would sit down to work and be like really productive, and then I'd get ready and I would go. well, now I just get up and start working. And all of a sudden I realized, oh my gosh, you know, the dogs didn't get a walk. I haven't done any of my exercises. I haven't kind of done my morning stretch or whatever. And then, you know, by the time it's like 4:30 in the afternoon, and then I'm thinking, well, when am I going to get my exercise? I mean, this ability just to turn on and start working immediately, you don't have to, right? But it just seems like, well, I'm here and there's my desk. I should just go. Putting breaks in. I mean, one thing that we did early on in the quarantine is we started getting our exercise at lunch. 11:30, 12 o'clock, we were out the door on the bikes or at the park or, you know, something. Clear your mind and then come back and get at it again. And that was really helpful. And we have to remind ourselves to do that a little bit more again.
I'm somebody who enjoys like going into work. And the lot of reasons, one of them is like having that transition time. But I also just find it reassuring. You know, I like going somewhere and knowing that I still have a desk and I can, you know, stick my head into my boss's office and just see how things are going, make sure he or she is happy with what I'm doing. What can I do or what can, you know, my supervisors do to make me feel more connected and more reassured when I spend so much time now just by myself?
We're spending a lot of time with people, but it's all virtual, right? It's on Zooms, which feels somewhat disconnected. So this idea of what's been for decades now called kind of managing by walking around, where you interact with people kind of more informally and just see how they're doing, as you say, stick your head in. And that's where a lot of kind of innovation and brainstorming and serendipitous interaction occurs. Zoom meetings are typically pretty intentional. You go in with an agenda and you cover those items, and there's not, other than kind of at the awkward, during the awkward moments at the beginning where everybody's kind of going, hey, we'll just sit here and wait for Rob. And then you just kind of sit there staring and just, you know, the idle comment. But it's really not very productive. So being more intentional about setting up sometimes. So for example, at some of my colleagues at Kelly, but also at Reagan Streif, started doing just lunches where they just have lunch virtually together and chat. And it's not, there's no agenda. It's not designed to accomplish a specific objective. Kim and I have both started scheduling with some of more regular meetings where we meet at a park or a place where we can walk and be socially distanced, but be outside and be active as opposed to just hunching over a screen kind of 24/7. So those are a couple things we've tried to work in. I can't say we or any of our colleagues are perfect at it, but I think you can start to balance a little bit more of that informal interaction if you're intentional about it.
Well, and I would add that I think that you need to ask people how they want to do it. I mean, I have a couple of people that I text constantly. I mean, probably talking more because they know, you know, I don't need to wait for an email. I'm not going to find you in the hall. I'm just going to text you. And I'm happy to be communicated by text. And you know what, if we have two or three texts in a row, I'm going to just call you. Right? So it is kind of like the drop in, right? You need to know what people are willing to do. So I know who I can text and I know who I shouldn't text. And sometimes I just even will text, hey, have you got 2 minutes? And then, you know, we talk so that we can still get that. I feel good about what you're doing. You feel good about what you're doing. And you know that I know what you're doing and I feel good about it.
You know, one of the suggestions that you made in your column this week was to explore how people are feeling, I guess, for supervisors to explore how supervisees are feeling. What can a supervisor do to make people feel safe about sharing their feelings about what they're doing? Because we're all worried about losing our jobs. And I don't think anybody wants to look like they're struggling.
I think historically, you know, the supervisor, the boss, the executive, whatever, had to kind of come across as a little bit invulnerable and, you know, the steady rock. And what I've seen work is, I think, starting by sharing your own vulnerabilities, your own challenges, and role modeling that it's okay to share that, and it doesn't mean you're weak or and so I think that's one. I hate to even call it a tactic because that sounds, you know, almost Machiavellian, but, you know, just be authentic and share how you're feeling. There aren't many people I know, if any, that aren't in some way feeling uncomfortable, uncertain, unsafe, or questioning, even if it's not for themselves, for a loved one, a parent, a child. a neighbor. And it's okay to kind of share that and use that as an opportunity to, again, role model and wait for response. Not everybody is going to be forthcoming, but allowing people to share. We've had a few different sessions, even with fairly large groups of people, and some of this came up around the racial inequities and some conversations we were having about how to manage that, where kind of the ball got rolling. And even with 100+ people, people were tuning in and getting very personal about their own experiences and sharing in their own frustrations and challenges. And that created a really powerful moment in something that might've been awkward in another venue, frankly.
So one of the ways I like to do it is to flip that on its head. And it's a lesson I've always known, and you know, from behavioral theory, and I'd forgotten until I read Max Yoder's book again, which is, and someone recently posted about how to start Zoom meetings again too, which is start with the positives. So I use a simple little question. I say, so what kind of wins have we had lately? And when people say, what do you mean by a win? I say, anything that made you feel good. I was really excited, you know, because the dog didn't go in the house. That's a win, right? Because we had a puppy at the time. And so, you know, and if you define a win first, and then what happens is once the wins come out, then it's easier to say, and so what are we still worried about?
I have a few suggestions from the readers. Tell me if you think that this makes sense. Managers need to be very vocal about forgiving emergencies that crop up during the workday.
Absolutely. Agreed. In fact, I see a lot of people come into Zoom and they apologize. They're like, well, I'm on my phone because, or I'm not showing my video because, and I try to lay it out there and I just say, we don't care. We care that you're here. Come in however you can come in. Be with us how you can be with us, and let's see what we can get done.
Managers need to avoid scheduling meetings on that same day.
I think that's more of a situational issue. I do think you need to be sensitive to people's schedules, but things come up that require urgent action, and sometimes that requires... Now, I do think, and I've seen people be not appropriately aware, perhaps even disrespectful of other people's windows. So, you know, with people with families with young kids, for example, scheduling meetings between, you know, 5 and 8 or on the weekends might be a challenge. So getting some buy-in, asking in advance when people are available and having some sense of that. But at the same time, emergencies do still come up and they sometimes still require urgent action. And I think individuals need to be responsive to that as well.
I think you bundle those first two, right? If you schedule a meeting on the same day, make it okay to miss out or come up with a contingency plan to how to bring in people that get missed.
Send me your thoughts by text or email if you're not able to join because of the late notice, something like that.
In reference to the idea of sort of unstructured communal time, make sure, you know, managers and your coworkers are okay with the kids being involved, you know, or, you know, you being able to do it when you're walking the dog or buying gasoline.
I would also push it back to managers. I have heard some managers say things like, we're not here to see your babies and your dogs or whatever. I mean, I really think that attitude needs to get worked on.
Wow, that's surprising.
I've had someone actually say that to me and a group. And I was like, I'm not really sure. In my case, it was a voluntary group. I'm like, I'm not really sure I can participate in the voluntary group because you see, my work and my home are the same place. I can't guarantee you my dog isn't going to be here. Or if you want me to do that much work in order to provide input, then it's going to be a challenge. How's this going to work? I mean, that's not very flexible.
Are there too many Zoom meetings? Are we kind of defaulting to the video meeting when maybe it could be something else?
Yes, I think there are times when the phone call is perfectly fine, that you don't need to be seeing each other and interacting in that way. So, and I think that's something people are discovering along the way, but something that is good to be intentional about. How do we, when and how do we manage so that the Zoom time is the most productive way to interact?
Is there any other way, you know, to make these more enjoyable?
I've been doing this for years, but I start every Zoom meeting. I have a song that's usually content appropriate, like we're doing an entrepreneurship session yesterday with some of my colleagues at Reagan Streif. And I have the Into the Unknown the Panic at the Disco version from Frozen 2. And I just started out the session with playing that while we waited for people to come in, and then just talked a little bit about how the song linked. Every class session that I start with a Zoom, I tee up a different, again, content appropriate song that I think people might enjoy, but also, you know, it's just kind of background. The other thing we did yesterday, and this was a new group and my first kind of experiment with this, but I asked everybody to bring up a virtual background or to even just have a physical picture they could hold up to the screen if they weren't sure or couldn't do the virtual background of one of their favorite places in the world. And we started off our session just by talking about where it was and what it meant to us. And it was a great way to kind of connect and spend time together virtually, but not feel like, okay, everybody, you know, pull out your notes and let's start the discussion.
Yeah, I also find it's a great way to get people to work together. So I've been experimenting with some like online collaboration tools where we're all doing it together instead of just talking. And so make it more of a working session. And if we want to then go to, you know, phone or whatever, we can. But the other big rule I would say is just because you scheduled a Zoom for a certain amount of time, don't feel like you have to use it all. I mean, I feel sometimes people are like stretching out to the last minute. You only got 20 minutes on a 30-minute Zoom, like, bye.
Okay, well, we'll use that cue from Kim to end the interview and the first portion of this program. Let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
The IBJ Podcast is brought to you by Krieg DeVault, a trusted and dynamic law firm representing a wide variety of local, regional, and national clients. Committed to each other and to every client, Krieg DeVault prides itself on integrity, professionalism, respect, and excellence. Financial institutions, global manufacturers, national healthcare providers, and successful organizations of all sizes and market focus rely on Krieg DeVault to create innovative and successful business solutions. Connect today at www.kriegdevault.com.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast. We're exploring ways that we can get out of the rut of remote work. Our second interview is with Karen Manja, Vice President of Customer and Market Insights for Salesforce out of its Indianapolis office. She has a secondary career as an author of books about career and personal success. Her latest is titled Working from Home. It's published by Wiley. It will be available online and at bookstores on August 25th. Here's our conversation.
I'd like to welcome Karen Manja, who is Vice President for Customer and Market Insights at Salesforce, and she serves on her company's Work From Home Task Force. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Mason. Great to be here.
I know you're based in Indianapolis, but do I understand correctly that you have been working from home for a long, long time?
I was working from home before it was cool and also before it was coerced. So I feel like that has been a long time of lessons learned from 2002 to present about what it takes to work from home effectively.
Now, you are not like kidding around. Could you briefly describe your workspace at home?
My workspace at home is a treadmill desk, because what I found is when I was working from home and sitting in that office chair all day, which was an upgrade from when I was working at my dining room table or occasionally from my bed, I was starting to get these back pains and just feeling very lack of energy. And what I found was when I stood up and added some movement to my day, I felt better. I was more productive. I got in those coveted 10,000 steps a day much more easily, and I felt better.
Yeah, and you mentioned in your book, a dedicated space is crucial. Why is that?
Work is a guest and it only shows up where it's invited. So if you invite work to your kitchen counter and your dining room table and your bed, it is the easiest gateway to the scope creep of work taking over and being an invited guest in every aspect of your life. And sometimes people will say, I struggle with having enough space to make that happen. And I call to mind a guy who showed me his dedicated workspace, and it was literally a tiny desk, barely a desk, in the corner of a room, and he had taken a piece of tape and put it down the middle of the desk. And he said, when I'm on this side, I do execution tasks like email and, you know, any number of things that need to be responded to. And then when I shift to the other side of the tape, that's when I'm in creative mode. I'm coming up with new ideas. You know, I'm authoring my blog posts. and thinking about, you know, my next big idea. And I thought, if he can do that in a tiny space and really delineate a line and subdivide work even, we can all find some kind of dedicated space to put work in our homes. Mm.
And I think one of the reasons why you do this is to send a signal to your brain that this is where I work. And when I'm in this space, I am to be working.
I find that people have this laptop and it's always on. And so every time you walk by and see it, you're tempted to snack on work, to kind of graze, you know, just one more email, just one more text, just one more slide, just one more blog, and suddenly your nights and weekends are gone. And what I found we all need to be purposeful about are routines, rituals, and boundaries. Mm-hmm. That getting ready and sending yourself a signal, I am dressed and in the zone and have gone through my ritual to go to work, and then I've established one to leave it. Otherwise, it's easy to always be grazing and always be on.
What's a ritual that I would use to start work?
Setting up that go-to-work routine where you say, I'm putting on work clothes, I'm getting my work beverage, and then I'm going to the place where work exists is a great way to mirror what that experience was like before when you had a go-to-work ritual of leaving home.
Now, in the back of my head, I can hear about 10 million parents saying, that's crazy, because my kids are pulling it at my knees or my legs. I mean, is there a way to still kind of get that sense of separated space while you still have children in the house?
One of the conversations that stood out to me when I was doing research for the book was a mom who was saying, you know, she's trying to balance that exact dynamic. And she wasn't used to working at home and her son wasn't used to being at home. And he's 4 years old. And so she would try to sit at the kitchen table and do a few emails to start the day while she was feeding him breakfast. And she found herself getting frustrated because he would keep talking to her. And what she discovered over time, what she realized was, you know, the signal to him is when we're sitting together at this kitchen table, this is a time when we do interact. I mean, this is where we're eating, we're talking, we're interacting. And so to him, the signal in his brain was, if mom's sitting here, this is what we do. And so that finding the routine and ritual that works for you with your kids is something that shifts. It takes a lot of experimentation. But something that helps is letting your kids know where you do your work. And also thinking about whatever you did to get ready for school and get on the bus or get out the door. And how can you mimic some of those routines and approaches when you're at home? Mm-hmm. It's imperfect.
Yeah.
But it's a way to at least get started.
What about rituals for ending your day?
I know a number of people who enjoy getting the people in the house and literally just taking a walk around the block, like a miniature commute together to leave work that says, now we're all coming home. Mm-hmm. It can be listening to music. It can be powering down your laptop. It can be meditation, writing in your journal, whatever works for you. But something that says, I now am transitioning and letting my brain know we're changing to a different mode. We're turning it off now. And then physically stepping away.
Now, I asked some folks on social media to suggest some tips for making sure they're productive during the day and accomplishing what they need to. And one of them brought up the concept of defensive calendaring. Does that ring a bell?
Well, tell me more. I'm curious. I mean, it takes me to a series of sports analogies, but tell me more about what your followers had in mind.
It is actually like establishing blocks of time that you cordon off yourself in your calendar. So, you know, I am going to be able to use this time between 1 and 3 or whatever it is to get work done. And when people try to schedule meetings with you, you do not give up that time. You say, no, I am busy. I cannot do that. And you try to hold the line as much as possible to preserve the time that you need.
I love that strategy. And what it makes me think about is a spinning fan right in front of us. I mean, imagine right now a fan that's going as fast as it can go. And then I say to you, could you please take this post-it note and put it through the slats in that fan? I mean, what's the easiest way to accomplish that task? You have to stop the fan. Yeah. Right. And so what I see is so many people spending their time and energy trying to make the time or the fan spin faster, thinking that that's the key to success, to doing more. Reality is when you stop the fan, when you do defensive calendaring and leave space to accommodate thinking, work tasks, life that doesn't go according to plan, happens is, I think when you stop the fan, you can see what's on the other side, which is what matters. It's the humanity. It's the people. It's some clarity of thought. I mean, you can't see what's on the other side of a fan that's constantly spinning.
You have three questions that you should ask yourself when you feel the urge, maybe to work at an odd time, you know, at 10 o'clock or before you go to bed or whatever. What are those three questions?
The three questions are, does it have to be? Does it have to be me? And does it have to be me right now? Because what happens is when we treat everything like it's important, the reality is nothing is important. And that's how we get into that mode of being always on.
I want to talk about supervisors for a minute. How is supervisor or supervising employees virtually different from supervising them in an office?
The question that is top of mind for every manager right now is, how do I know my employees are working? Mm-hmm. And you see people taking a myriad of approaches to that. And one of the things that strikes me, and I was having a conversation with a guy named Seth Madison, a friend of mine who did a lot of research on this topic, literally surveying people. And when he was asking people managers what was most important to them right now, I mean, what was really missing? And two fundamental factors came back. It's that people, especially people managers, are feeling isolated and invisible. And so what's happening, and my hypothesis out of that is, I think that especially that middle line of managers, so not your most senior executives and not your individual contributors, but that middle layer sitting between the front line and the top line is the one that's taking the brunt of this transition. And the success or failure of work from home and how sustainably can people do that rests with equipping them with being heard, being trained, and having crystal clear priorities about what success looks like. Because I feel like that's the group, and I recall when I was a middle manager myself, I mean, I've never worked so hard to have so many people think I was doing nothing. I was visiting with a colleague and we were a couple months into this new pattern. And he said, you know what I realized? I realized my goal is to have great relationships with my team and understand how to help them. And my calendar is set up in a way that that is almost statistically impossible. And he purposefully took meetings off of his calendar and left blank space so that he could do just the random connection and check in, you know, how are you doing? And he was realizing if he didn't have time available on his calendar for some of those more natural interactions, he had the right goal and just absolutely no time on his calendar to execute that. Mm-hmm. So I think that's certainly the first piece of it. The other piece too is the managers connecting with each other and sharing ideas. I mean, there's something about a community of other people who are in your shared circumstance where you can say, this is what I'm struggling with. Have you cracked the code or do you have a tip? And I see teams now, as I'm meeting with lots of companies, having managers do little training sessions with each other where in 5 to 7 minutes, someone will share a tip about something they're doing differently that's leading to some results. And it builds a go-to place where people can collaborate and find some camaraderie and also be seen.
I have some suggestions, again, from readers. Tell me, did these make sense to you? One is they wish that managers would respect like regular work times and not get into the habit of thinking that people are available all the time.
So one of the most powerful things that managers can do is to openly talk about those routines, rituals, and boundaries, and to revisit some expectations. And some of those involve working hours. I mean, if you're in a role, I mean, if you are in customer service, for example, and your role requires being on a phone during a certain period of time, that's a role that can lend itself to some more specific hours. Other roles don't work quite that same way. But what I'm discovering is we are all shift workers now. And we need to take that mentality that says, when do I clock in and when do I clock out? And if there's other work that needs to happen, the basis of that is trust. You don't have to see me to know that I'm getting something done. I don't have to instantly respond to you to still be a high performing, high impact, high quality employee.
Yeah. And that was the next one, which was managers need to trust that the employees are going to get it done. And it might be on a totally different schedule than they used to be able to do it, but they need to trust that they can get it done and should not be micromanaged or in meetings all day.
You know, the question for managers who are trying to get out of the overwhelm is, what can I give my team to own? Where can they take greater ownership in a decision or a process or a path forward that maybe saves us all some time? And for employees, it's, what do you see that you could take ownership of that might make everybody more productive, less anxious, deliver more outcomes? And thinking through ownership and accountability as shared, not a way to get out of work, but how can we revisit who's deciding what and where is the line on what decisions employees are empowered to make, and has that shifted in this context? So, I mean, if it used to be that you needed $100 approved from your manager, in this period of time, could that be $125? And would that give everyone greater ownership and maybe have fewer emails and fewer meetings? And then we would all feel better and still get things done. What great communicators do is they speak what's in the room. So if what you're sensing as a manager or as an employee is, I'm not clear about what success looks like right now, or I'm not clear about the priorities or my role in those, it's a time to ask. So for managers, that can be saying to your team or to your employee, are you clear on what our priorities look like right now? Let's talk about how those have shifted since last we met. And if you're an employee, I think what I've found always works really well is make that list of everything that you're working on, because your manager doesn't always know, right? All the things that might be taking your time, roughly equate what percentage of your time you're spending on it, and then ask, am I spending time on the right things? Is this what you're expecting of me now? Because everybody wants to put their time and energy toward delivering something that's relevant, that's high impact. I mean, nobody wants to feel like you spent a bunch of time on something that in the end, someone was like, oh, why were you working on that? So ask, speak into the room what needs to be said. And that doesn't take 17 slides. Just ask them.
Well, good. Let's jump into video meetings real quick then. How should we be mindful of how a virtual meeting is different from an in-person meeting?
The simplest messages are the strongest. Simplify your message. Instead of that crazy roadmap slide with 150 things on it, make the first slide the outcomes that you want to deliver, or cut to the punchline, then ask your audience where they want to engage. It's remarkable what happens when you just say what needs to be said without 17 slides. Come straight at the point and then invite conversation, as opposed to your face is tiny on the screen and then people are just watching slide after busy slide roll by wondering why they're there.
One of my pet peeves, since I have a little bit of a background in video production, is how poorly some people present themselves on video. What are three or four things that anybody could do to just improve their visual presence?
Yes, three things to improve your visual presence. First, be conscious of what's behind you. And if that sends the signal about how you want to show up. You know, is that your piles of dirty laundry and a strange collectible or an unusual light hanging from the ceiling? Is that visually how you want to show up? Second is lighting. Be conscious of the lighting and having ideally natural light, but if not, use a lamp or, you know, some kind of ring light and have the light coming toward you so we can see your face. And you can also just take your phone and kind of scan around so that you can easily see or record a little video. It'll give you a sense of what your audience sees in the background. Third is look right into the camera. So where you're looking down or you're looking up, it just gives people an odd sensation of not having a face-to-face conversation with you. And it's distracting, especially at this point.
One of the things that I always try to make sure I do, and a lot of people, I guess, aren't really cognizant of it, is making sure that the camera is sort of on the same plane as your eyes.
Yes.
And not positioned like significantly lower than your eyes, which then of course highlights your nostrils when you're trying to talk. And another thing is making sure, I mean, your face fills the frame.
Yes.
You know, that you're not off into the corner somewhere. And that lighting thing just drives me bonkers, where a lot of people, you know, will do it in front of a window where there's light coming out of the window. And has the effect of making them a silhouette. So now I cannot see anything. I can't pick up any visual cues on their face. And it sort of looks like, you know, they're in a witness protection program. Yeah, I like what you said about making sure that there is light shining on your face.
Well, right. I think about how much time and effort people spend in their careers trying to be seen and to get noticed. Mm-hmm. And now being seen and getting noticed is fully within your control, at least on a video call. So let your face be seen and make sure that we can hear you. Because at this point, you know, people around you are upping their game. You know, people are doing these fantastic backgrounds and, you know, high quality audio. And, you know, the expectation is rising. It was funny at the beginning and everybody was tolerant when the adjustment was sudden and unexpected. We're months into it now. Mm-hmm. It's time to raise your game. I mean, I think about your home office as your new context. It's your new dress for success. And are you showing up and dressing to the position and to the status that you want to achieve?
Run through lightning round real quick. Of tips that you brought up. One, test the technology that you're using during your presentation beforehand.
There is nothing more stressful than giving a high stakes pitch, whether that's to your boss or your customer, and you get on and nothing is working. You will be so distracted. There is no possible way you can show up at your best. And then even if you get everything working, you're kind of frazzled. So do yourself the favor of making it easy. We've all been there. It worked once. It didn't work this time. Test every aspect.
Prepare a compelling prompt. What do we mean by prompt?
Think about something that gets your audience to either engage immediately because you've made a sentence or a statement that's so direct they want to know more. So for example, if I said to you, I'm feeling very 2020. You'd be like, what does that mean? It shocks you into tuning into what I'm saying. The other piece is to ask a question that you're going to give everyone the opportunity to respond to, whether that's in the chat, whether that's in the dialogue at the end, and you're letting them know in advance, the participation is coming soon, so start thinking about your answer. So something that tunes people into, we're interacting, and this is something different than your regular conversation or run-of-the-mill readout.
Share some element of the agenda, but not necessarily all the agenda?
Well, you want to share enough of the agenda so that people know why they are there, that they're prepared and it's going to be a good use of their time. Not so much of the agenda that people tune out because they have decided they already know what you're going to say.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm trying to compress and simplify.
Well, well done.
My thanks again to Karen Mondra and Kim and Todd Saxton. Folks, before you get on with the rest of your week, I do want to draw your attention to a few stories from this week's print edition of IBJ. First up, Indiana University Health's plan to overhaul and expand its Methodist Hospital campus downtown exacerbates a challenge already weighing on Marion County. Huge swaths of land exempt from property taxes because they're owned by hospitals, educational institutions, and other not-for-profits. John Russell examines the potential impact. Also in this week's issue, Susan Orr sorts through the bushel of challenges suddenly facing downtown City Market, which have swept into the historic space with the speed of the pandemic. And Mickey Shuey explores the process of planning the $550 million redevelopment of Pan Am Plaza in a Q&A with Bill Brown, president of Ratio Architects. Again, you can find these stories in the latest issue of IBJ or online at ibj.com. I will say that it is a lot easier to get access to all of IBJ's award-winning business content if you have a subscription. It works out to about $2 per week, which is pretty good for the amount of information that can help you make important decisions here in the next few months. Just go to ibj.com and click on the subscribe button. Hey, thanks again for making the time this week for the IBJ podcast. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.